Hi, everyone. I am your host of the Midlife Wellness NP podcast. My name is Kim Hefner. I am a family nurse practitioner that is passionate about helping women optimize their health and hormones in midlife and beyond. I recently had the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Michael Twyman, a functional cardiologist who is dedicated to identifying the root causes of heart disease and preventing its onset. Dr. Twyman takes a unique approach to cardiology by incorporating biohacking into his practice to provide personalized care. During our conversation, we delved into various topics, including the significance of vascular age in assessing cardiovascular risk, the role of inflammation in heart health, and advanced testing methods used to evaluate heart risk. We also discussed the impact of hormones and menopause on heart health and the importance of protecting our mitochondria and the potential benefits of photomodulation for heart health. Dr. Twyman shared valuable insights on hormone therapy, signs and symptoms that midlife women should be vigilant about regarding heart health, and the four pillars of health. This conversation is one of the most valuable ones I have had yet. I can't wait to share it with you. If you're interested in learning more about Dr. Twyman's practice and his approach to functional cardiology, you can find him on social media as Dr. Michael Twyman or visit his website, drtwyman.com/ApolloCardiology. You can listen to the Midlife Wellness NP podcast on all podcast platforms and find me on YouTube. Thank you for being here and enjoy the episode. Hi, Dr. Twyman. Welcome to the podcast. Thank you so much for being here.
You're very welcome. Thank you for the opportunity.
I'm excited to share with everybody the cool things that you do. So if we could just start there, what do you do? And who are you and what do you do?
So I'm a board-certified cardiologist. My practice is Apollo Cardiology in St. Louis, Missouri, and we help people not have heart attacks or strokes. So take an integrative functional medicine approach to really get to the root cause of people's cardiovascular concerns and really stop heart disease in its tracks.
That is so awesome and so needed. What I love about you is that you still do traditional medicine. You're not opposed to it. You combine them. So, which is great because that's what's needed. When patients come to see you, what's the difference between a visit with a traditional cardiologist and a visit with you? What can they expect? And what are some of the different things that you do differently?
So I, did my conventional training and then, I've spent probably tens of thousands of dollars and hours in training myself in integrative functional cardiology. And then in the past few years, I added kind of the biohacking and then the quantumology information as well. And so I can still do traditional cardiology when needed. And it's a tool. And sometimes that tool is necessary. But oftentimes, if you can optimize the person's lifestyle, deficiencies in nutraceuticals, if there's something that you can fix, do it the simplest way possible for that person. And in a traditional system, they're much more focused on treating symptoms. Now you're having chest pain, shortness of breath, palpitations. They're trying to figure out what's going on there. Where more of my patients now are coming in not having any symptoms. Or like my dad had a heart attack at 55 and I don't want to go down that route. What did I inherit from them? And what do I have control over? And also we just have a little bit better technology and time. In the traditional cardiology world, you maybe have 20 or 30 minutes to see somebody. We spend at least an hour with every single new patient and really dive into, tell me about your mom's history. How healthy was your mom as a kid? Because you inherit your mitochondria from your mom. It's very important for us to know that. Yeah, we go through nutrition, exercise. That's important, but often stress management isn't always discussed. Sleep optimization isn't discussed. And then we have a whole host of non-invasive devices to tell you, how healthy your arteries are that just don't usually see in a general cardiology office.
Yeah, that's awesome. So let me ask you this. We have aspirin therapy. We have statin therapy. We have advanced testing. We have heart-healthy diets. So why is heart disease still the number one killer of both men and women?
Because the root cause isn't always addressed. And the root cause is endothelial dysfunction and above the endothelium, some called the glycocalyx. So your arteries have a protective coating. Think of it like Teflon or a nonstick surface. That surface gets damaged. Then the cholesterol particles, the white blood cells, they can stick to your arteries. And then the plaques build up. Those tools you mentioned, aspirin prevents the platelets from aggregating or sticking. There's multiple lipid-lowering therapies. But the root is that the lining of the arteries is getting damaged, and you haven't yet fixed that problem. And so it's sort of like putting your fingers in a dike. You can hold certain things back, but eventually the dam still breaks. So that was sort of the impetus of why I kind of went down this pathway. I was an invasive cardiologist for many years and treated many, many heart attacks. And many of those patients are already on aspirin, blood pressure medicine, statins. It's like, why do they keep having events if they're on the quote, you know, right medications? Because we didn't get to the root cause. We didn't fix the endothelium. We didn't address the inflammation sometimes. And so that is really the challenges. You have to do further testing to know how healthy the endothelium, the glycocalyx are.
Yeah, I love this saying, a man is as old as his arteries. And that sticks with me when I'm evaluating patients too, especially women in the menopausal years, because I'm always thinking about, you know, the vessels leading to their heart. So, and that's one of the reasons I started following you actually, is because you have that similar viewpoint and all of like looking at all these other ways of detecting heart disease. So how is this saying relevant to the root cause of heart disease?
Looking at these testing. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the saying that a man is as old as his arteries, that was from a physician in the 1600s. They were recognizing that, you know, if you didn't take care of your arteries, you didn't have longevity. And obviously longevity is a buzzword right now. Mm-hmm. But the key is, you know, you can be very healthy on the outside. You can exercise routinely. You can eat a healthy Mediterranean diet. You can still have significant vascular disease because you have high lipoprotein little A, you have high homocysteine. Now there's up to 400 different risk factors that can damage your arteries. And there's only three responses. And this is something I learned from Dr. Mark Cusin, who's one of my mentors. You know, the arteries can only respond with either oxidative stress, inflammation, or autoimmune dysregulation. So basically, your arteries are on fire, and they're the innocent bystanders to whatever else is causing that damage. So you just really have to do the right testing to know, well, are their arteries aging appropriately or not? Or are your arteries older than you're expecting? I just recently saw a gentleman who was, you know, biologically 43, his arteries were 80 years old.
Wow.
Had a 5-alarm fire in his arteries that we had to put out. And he had no idea that he was at such high risk. And that's what we're trying to prevent, is the person who had no idea that they're at risk, and then they go out and have a cardiovascular event. Now, I often tell the story of, you know, Bob Harper, the gentleman from The Biggest Loser. He was, you know, early 50s, very, very fit individual. He had a heart attack in the gym. If it wasn't for the quick thinking of a medical student there, who got an AED defibrillator and, you know, helped resuscitate him, he probably wouldn't have lived. But when he eventually got treated, he had ruptured a plaque in his left anterior descending artery. He had a heart attack. You know, they fixed him in the cath lab. And then a few days later, you know, he wakes up in the ICU. He's like, what happened? They're like, you had a heart attack. He was shocked because he thought he was very fit and couldn't possibly happen to him. But on, you know, the further deep dive, they found out he had lipoprotein little A, which is a lipoprotein that up to 20% of the population has. And this lipoprotein can double the risk that you have vascular disease over somebody who doesn't have it. And so you just have to get this test done one time in your life to know if you're at higher risk or not.
You know, I've learned more about that because I tested a 17-year-old girl. She was having all of these different things and hers was really elevated. So that's when I started digging into the research about it. That's a little further down the way, but yeah, I read that it also elevates in menopause, which was kind of confusing because in my mind, I'm like, oh, this is just a genetic thing, you know, and I've also read there's not a whole lot to mitigate that risk. But what do you say about that? And what, when you see that as an elevated marker, what do you recommend?
Sure. And to answer the one question, the reason you see it going up in menopause is the estrogen's dropping. Estrogen is cardioprotective and will suppress LPLA. Now, there's many reasons people may be on hormone replacement therapy, and, you know, I'm not opposed to women being on it, but that is not an indication to start estrogen therapy. It's just high LPLA. Right now, there are not great pharmaceutical options at lowering LPLA. There's drugs in development. One class of them is called the antisense oligonucleotides. This class of medication basically goes to the liver and shuts off the protein from being made in the liver, so you can't make the LPLA particles. It's going to be very effective at lowering LPA, but they're currently doing trials to figure out, are people having less events, heart attacks, strokes, stents, bypass, death, the things that really matter to patients. Mm-hmm. But you first check to see, do you have high levels of lipoprotein A? Second, there's some tests you can look at that say, is LPLA likely contributing to some issues to the arteries? There's an inflammatory marker called LPPLA2. If that's elevated, your arteries are on fire. If you have high oxidized LDL or oxidized phospholipid ApoB, your cholesterol particles are getting damaged and modified. Those get transported through these Lp(a) particles. And then there's a newer lab that I'm checking people called interleukin-6. Interleukin-6 was very high when people would have COVID. The spike proteins would damage the gel coat, the glycocalyx of the artery, and then the IL-6 levels would be very high. But high levels of IL-6 is a marker that the glycocalyx is inflamed. And the higher the IL-6, it actually upregulates the liver's production of Lp(a). Mm-hmm. So if you lower this marker, they'll probably have a little bit less Lp(a) numbers. But I tend to think about it as Lp(a) is what's floating through their blood, and you have to test the arteries themselves. Because I have patients who have sky-high levels of Lp(a), and they have really no significant vascular disease. I have younger individuals in their 50s have moderately level Lp(a), and they have very high CT coronary calcium scans. And individuals have to get, you know, their aortic valves replaced earlier because the Lp(a) can damage the aortic valve. So it's one of those things where you have to actually go looking at the arteries in the aortic valve to make sure that Lp(a) isn't doing damage. Mm-hmm.
So Lp(a) is an increased risk for cardiac disease, but what is it doing to the vessels? Is it making them stickier? Is it making them, like, what's exactly happening in there what is it doing?
So Lp(a) is a lipoprotein. And for anybody watching the video, I'll describe it as well. The lipoproteins are like tennis balls. They're spherical. The cholesterol, the triglycerides, the phospholipids, the fat-soluble vitamins, they all go inside these lipoproteins. And so the tennis ball analogy, this is basically like LDL particles. Lp(a) is an LDL particle that's got an extra little protein on the outside of it. So there's like this little corkscrew that sits on the outside of this tennis ball. That corkscrew is the lipoprotein A protein, or the apolipoprotein A protein, I should say. That protein is more atherogenic and thrombogenic, meaning it's more likely to develop plaque in the arteries, and it's more likely to cause the blood to clot. So that is what it's causing, is it increases the risk of plaque in the arteries and the blood to clot. Now, why do so many people have Lp(a)? Maybe up to 20% of the population has high levels. There are some theories. One of the theories is that, it's because it helps with blood clotting. Maybe it was very useful for maternal blood loss. And so your ancestors 10,000 years ago didn't die during childbirth. And so, I was doing a previous webinar talking about longevity and vascular health. And I was surprised to find out that, the current, life expectancy in the U.S. right now is 78 years, but in 1900, it was 49. So Lp(a) probably wouldn't have caused, vascular disease that you would have had at events in your 40s. You wouldn't have lived long enough. Now people hope to live to 80, 90 years old or greater, and Lp(a) is more likely to contribute to vascular disease in those decades.
It's interesting because I also wonder, just learning more about it, if it did have some sort of beneficial role. And I actually listened to some other things, and that's why I was like, how concerned should you be about it? But definitely learning what it does to the vessels. So it doesn't seem like there's a lot of things to do that would really impact that. But is aspirin something candidates that are able to take aspirin, baby aspirin, is that something that you can do if they're, able to do that?
For sure. Yeah. So if people have evidence of thickening of their carotid arteries, or they have soft plaque building up in their coronary arteries or any other vascular system, then yes, aspirin is often indicated in those individuals. But if it was like an 8-year-old girl with Lp(a), would you start aspirin in an 8-year-old? I don't know. The data would be beneficial. I think the risk of, gastric ulcers would probably outweigh the risk of, I would say, the benefit of cutting down on atherosclerotic or thrombotic events. So it has to be individualized to the patient, but somebody over the age of 40, probably aspirin would probably be a reasonable option as long as they're not high risk of bleeding.
When you talk about inflammation, I think patients often don't really understand how that can be a root cause of heart disease. Do you mind just talking a little bit about what exactly inflammation is doing and how, that process is happening and contributing to heart health?
So I usually describe inflammation as something that is beneficial, but when it's chronic, that's when it becomes maladaptive. So if you have an infection, you want your immune system to ramp up, fight off the infection, and then turn back down, or think of, if you sprain your ankle is going to turn red, swollen, it'll be painful. That's inflammation healing that injury. But you have nearly 60,000 miles of blood vessels. they're going to be transporting different components through that waterway to the site of injury. Those inflammatory markers, the cytokines, the interleukins, those will be interacting with that protective gel coat in the artery, the glycocalyx. That inflammation can scratch up the glycocalyx. And then the white blood cells and the cholesterol particles that are floating through the blood, they now start being attracted to the endothelial lining. You know, it's like Velcro. So the inflammation damages the gel coat, and then what floats through the blood starts sticking to the artery walls.
So what other markers, what do you assess for inflammation of the vessels and just in general? What are you looking for?
There's multiple lab values that you can assess, but a few of them would be high sensitivity CRP. Generally, the level should be less than one. Some more vascular specific ones, I already mentioned it before, but it's the LPPLA2. That enzyme, if it's elevated, means the arteries are inflamed, more likely plaque is building up. Myeloperoxidase, or MPO. Myeloperoxidase is what white blood cells use to kill bacteria, sort of like bleach. But if that bleach gets onto your HDL particles, it basically will destroy them. So high myeloperoxidase is often a marker that there's inflammation in the artery walls as white blood cells are going in there and gobbling up what's below an intimal layer. There are other markers that look at, markers of like endothelial health. So that's like asymmetric dimethylarginine, symmetric dimethylarginine, homocysteine, uric acid. You can look at the oxidized LDL fractions. There's many things that you can look at. And these advanced lab companies, such as Boston Heart Lab and Cleveland Heart Lab, the panels are very well organized, where like green values are optimal, yellow is borderline, and red's a higher risk fire. So I usually tell patients, they have a lot of red on these panels. You have a lot of fire potentially in the arteries. We got to try to put the fires out to really start reducing the risk.
So can you reverse that? Can you reverse, like, for instance, my myeloperoxidase was elevated after I had COVID. I did a whole panel. Mm-hmm. So what type of strategies do you utilize? I mean, because it's pretty scary to have all of these things elevated. It's nerve-wracking and scary. And what do you recommend? What strategies? Where do you start?
So I'll always start with the basics. I mean, the four big levers, is what is that person fueling their body with? How are they moving their body through space? Exercise, essentially. How are they managing their stress? And how well are they sleeping? And of the four, I would always start with sleep first, because it's probably the most important lever. If you're not sleeping well, you will not recover well. So, you can be eating a perfectly clean, Mediterranean paleo diet. You can be exercising 7 days a week. If you don't sleep well, it's like beating up a car, never changing its spark plugs, never changing the oil, and expecting to go 200 miles an hour the next day. It's just not going to happen. You need sleep to repair the mitochondria. And so that's where I would focus, is getting high quality sleep. If you've got all that stuff dialed in, well, then that's when you start looking at the different biomarkers and say, okay, well, what supplement, what medication can I use to support the body to get back to homeostasis? Because often a lot of the healing is just getting out of the body's way.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned uric acid, and I've started to check this more because actually reading the work of Peter Attia, learning so much more about it. What it seems like it can be really looked at beyond gout. People think about it as gout. Why is this marker so important? And what is it? What picture is it giving us on what lifestyle things we're doing?
So yes, you mentioned that uric acid, many people think about, gout from it, that uric acid crystals form in the joint space and that causes pain. Frequently it's in like the big toe joints. But the biggest things that drive uric acid are fructose, especially in the sources like high fructose corn syrup or liquid, sources of fructose. And then the other big drivers of it is alcohol, especially beer. And then the other one is purines. So some people have a harder time breaking down purines than others. If you have normal kidney function, you shouldn't have as big of a problem with that. But there are certain genes that people have that they don't make the enzyme that breaks uric acid down efficiently. So you may want to first work with some kind of, lifestyle intervention. So cut down on their fructose intake if they're drinking orange juice, or they're drinking a lot of alcohol more than they let on. That might be the source of the extra uric acid. But then often you have to start supporting with, tart cherry juice or using pharmaceuticals like allopurinol or colchicine. Because if you lower uric acid, you will lower something that causes oxidative stress to the glycocalyx. So that is really the thought pattern behind why you want uric acid to be lower. It's somewhat of a check engine light on how healthy your metabolism is. I usually shoot for levels under 6 and optimally less than 5.
So you are comfortable using medications. I even read like doing a low dose of colchicine can be utilized for that, mitigating uric acid. But what about supplements? Is there anything else? I know like OrthoMolecular has a supplement. Could that be something that you try prior to medication? Or does that just depend on the level?
I think it would depend on the level and also on their symptomatology of anything. Like if they're already having gout flares, you're probably going to use the bigger guns. Mm-hmm. If it's just asymptomatic, mildly elevated uric acid, and you've already tried the lifestyle interventions to make it try to come down and it doesn't, then I think it's possibly reasonable to use some of the supplementation. But I don't usually have many patients in that category.
Oh, you usually have them higher?
Yeah, they're usually higher.
They're coming to you. They're up. Let's talk about ApoB. We've been hearing a lot more about that. In my mind, and this could be wrong, I think about things like this. If I can fix inflammation, if I can keep insulin low, if I can take care of ApoB, I fix a lot. What do you think about that? Talk about ApoB and why. Is this a reflection of one's diet? What can we do about it?
So apolipoprotein B, or ApoB as in like beta for short, is the lab value that you can look at that encompasses all the lipoproteins that can injure your arteries. So back to the tennis ball analogy. So the tennis ball is the lipoprotein, the lipid protein carrier. They're spherical. But wrapping the tennis ball is a white stripe. That white stripe is analogous to the ApoB protein. It's a structural protein, so it holds this thing together in the sphere. And ApoB is also a ligand. Basically, it's like a key that then fits into a lock. So apolipoprotein B is on the outside of your LDL particles, your VLDL particles, your ILDL particles, and LPLA particles if you have high levels of LPLA. The lion's share of the ApoB is on the outside of the LDL particles. So particles predict risk. The more particles you have floating around in your blood vessels, the more interactions they potentially have with the glycocalyx. So it's a shots on goal type of analogy. So if you already have evidence that the lipoproteins are getting into your artery wall and you have plaque, you're going to want to lower your lipoprotein burden. And so you can track ApoB relatively easily with blood testing. So generally, the 20th percentile ApoB is 70. If your ApoB is greater than 70 and you have plaque in your arteries, you want to try to do something to get it down lower. If you have significant vascular disease, you would likely probably want to be in the 5th percentile and have an ApoB of 55 or less. Mm. Often, that's going to require pharmaceutical agents to get you down to those reference ranges. Back to your question, is it nutrition? In some people, but not all. Okay. Yeah, there's probably 3,000 genes that affect lipid metabolism. The two biggest levers you can pull on from nutrition is that the person is insulin resistant or pre-diabetic, and they have evidence that they have high triglycerides, low HDL. Okay, then there may be some strategy of lowering their carbohydrate load, increasing their resistance training, and trying to get the insulin resistance reversed. You may want to add on supplementations or medications to help that. But if you reverse insulin resistance and their ApoB is still high, keep diving in further. The other case that is often high from a nutritional strategy is when people do a keto diet or a high saturated fat version of a carnivore diet. Saturated fat in some individuals really raises cholesterol production in their liver. They have to make more ApoB-containing lipoproteins. And the high saturated fat also downregulates the LDL receptor. The LDL receptor sitting on the outside of the liver, grabbing these ApoB particles as they go by. So it's kind of a double whammy for some people. Mm-hmm. Not everybody. So some people, if they cut back on the saturated fat, their ApoB particles come down. Then you kind of can do some testing to figure out, is it more that their body's producing too much cholesterol, or is their body not able to eliminate the cholesterol from the GI system? There's a test called the cholesterol balance test that looks at that. Mm. Analogy that you can use is like, think of a bathtub filling up with water. You can prevent the water from overflowing the bathtub two main ways. you can reach in there and turn off the faucet. That's essentially shut down some of the cholesterol production in the liver. That would be like utilizing a statin or bempedoic acid or the supplements bergamot or red yeast rice. Make less cholesterol, make less lipoproteins. But the other analogy could be that is the drain plugged up? There's supplements that would need to be used or medications to open up the drain so that the water slash cholesterol gets into your GI system and it's eliminated from the body. Because that's the only way cholesterol leaves the body is through the GI system. So sometimes you have to pull on one or other lever. Sometimes you got to pull on both of those levers.
So we mentioned statins, and I was going to ask you about that. They're often demonized, but it seems they do have a role and they're still beneficial for some people. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because you have patients, I'm sure, that are like, there is no way I'm taking a statin. I've heard terrible things. I had a person on Twitter list all of the diseases the other day that a statin will cause, liver failure, you name it. So just touch on statins a little bit. Who would benefit from a statin? And the other question I have is, for people that are afraid to take them or they don't tolerate them, could they still be beneficial taking it maybe one or two times a week as opposed to every single day?
Those are great questions, and that's definitely the bread and butter questions I get on my own social media and when I'm working with patients, you know, one-on-one. Yeah, I often start off with that statins are tools, and you have to use the right tool for the right job. So I don't think statins should be in the water and everybody be taking them, and I don't think they're poison that everybody should be running from. But there are certain people that will have more benefit than others. There's really no doubt, even in the general cardiology world, that secondary prevention, people will benefit. So if you already had a heart attack, stroke, stents, bypass, statins will significantly reduce your risk of having another event. No questions asked. Where the gray zone comes in sometimes is primary prevention. You have, quote, high cholesterol. Does statin reduce your risk? It will sort of depend on what else is going on with the vascular system. So I will often use this advanced testing to try to figure out, is this person going to likely tolerate the statin therapy? So the major side effects of statins generally are muscle related, muscle pain, weakness, fatigue, and extremely rare muscle death or what's known as rhabdomyolysis. I've been practicing for over 20 years. I've never seen a case of rhabdomyolysis from statins. I was a physician in the military for a while. I saw a lot of rhabdomyolysis from people exercising and getting heat stroke. It does not happen often with statins. I believe the literature is 1 in 10,000 cases, maybe even higher than that. But the muscle symptoms are real. And it may be, you know, more than the 5 to 10% of the population that in the clinical trials that they report. So I always tell people, we're not going to know how you respond until you try something. But the people who tend to have less issues with muscle symptoms will be an ApoE3 or 2 carrier. The ApoE4s tend to have more issues. Mm-hmm. There's another gene called SLCO1B1. It's a statin myopathy gene. If you have that gene, you probably should not be on high doses of statins, or maybe you could do the intermittent dosing. I'll talk about that in a second. Then things that also cause muscle symptoms, low vitamin D, low CoQ10, hypothyroidism. If you have those and you throw a statin on board, people tend to have more muscle symptoms. So I always want to make sure people are optimized for initiating the treatment. The other thing is I talked about the cholesterol balance test. Now, this is not going to be in guidelines, but it's just the art and science of medicine, is that if you're a hyperproducer of sterols, you'll probably be a hyper-responder to being on a statin. But if you're a hyper-absorber of sterols, where basically the cholesterol is not leaving the body, statins won't work nearly as efficiently. That's the case where you'd use ezetimibe to block the cholesterol from being reabsorbed. Mm-hmm. Now, there are certain people that can't tolerate, you know, statins daily at moderate to high doses. So what do you do for these people? Well, sometimes you can get away with using some of the statins twice a week at low doses. Often, you won't be able to do just monotherapy with them. You'll have to add ezetimibe or some other type of supplement to help support the body's clearance of the lipoproteins. But some statin sometimes is better than none because there's other benefits than just lowering cholesterol. There's this anti-inflammatory lowering effect of statins. They can help stabilize plaques. Mm-hmm. So they can take the soft plaque that's more likely to rupture and cause a heart attack and turn them to be calcified and more solid. You know, there's some effect where it may help with the endothelial function. So even if it's not going to get your cholesterol particles to go, you may still be getting some other benefits from being on the lower doses, even if it's infrequently dosed.
Okay. I Totally agree. And I'm so glad you mentioned that the other benefits of statins, because I don't think people really understand that and why they can be useful. So when you think about women in midlife and, you know, going through menopause, are there certain markers that you look at differently, like the triglyceride to HDL ratio? Are there ones that are more specific to women, or do you don't really see much difference in what you're looking for? Like, I read once that that was a little better predictor for women, but I could be wrong.
I mean, I will look at the triglyceride to HDL ratio, but it's not very sensitive as a marker of insulin resistance.
Okay.
So you'll want to look at fasting insulin, small LDL. Those are going to be more, you know, sensitive markers of insulin resistance. But I don't necessarily think that there's any particular marker that I would look at in only women. It's, you know, looking at men and women, but it often is with the drawdown of estrogen levels that they start becoming more insulin resistant, and you start seeing this change in their lipoproteins. You know, their HDL fractionization goes down, their LDL fractionization or ApoB tends to go up. And something that's a little bit more where, you know, you wouldn't think necessarily about this being linked, but like when women start, you know, becoming osteoporotic or osteopenic, well, that's a red flag that they may have vascular disease. You're pulling calcium out of one system, that calcium may be going other places. So if you're osteopenic, you need to get a test that looks at your vascular system as well.
Wow, that is so true. Right. Because, and that kind of plays into the benefits of taking K2 with the D3, right? To keep, right. I always recommend that. Well, you mentioned women and estrogen. So of course I have to go here. You know, as women go through the menopause transition, of course, we're losing estrogen. But unfortunately, things like cortisol, inflammation, insulin resistance are increasing, working against us, not only increasing our cardiac risk, but our weight, and which will increase all of those other bad things that can happen to us. I want you to try to explain, you know, what's going on with insulin resistance? Why are these high blood sugars? Why is high insulin? What is it doing to our vessels to increase our cardiac risk?
So it comes back to the glycocalyx, the gel coat in your arteries. So another way to think about it is like, think of, you take a fish out of the water and the fish is slimy. That's kind of what the coating of your arteries has. That coating is basically a sugar coating. That coating is very fragile. Two of the biggest things that damage it are high glucose levels and high insulin levels. So if you become insulin resistant, that is like the fire that's going to start really scratching up your artery walls. And so once you realize somebody's becoming insulin resistant, that has to be your primary focus. How do you start reversing that? Because insulin resistance is definitely reversible. Sometimes it's reversible just with lifestyle interventions. Sometimes you may need some supplemental intervention, and sometimes you may need pharmaceutical intervention. But it's not a failure if you need to use pharmaceutical agents short term. It may not be long term. You're just, like I tell patients, sometimes you need to put out the 5-alarm fire, fix some of the other things, then de-prescribe, get people off certain medications. But you know, your insulin resistance often starts in your skeletal muscle. So this is a lot of the work of my friend, Dr. Lyon. So muscle-centric medicine is her philosophy. So if you're becoming insulin resistant, you have to think about what you can do to support your skeletal muscle. And this is where many women, you know, often work out, but they do it at the detriment of doing significant resistance or strength training. They're doing a lot of cardio, yoga. Those are great activities, and I don't talk people away from them, but you have to have some amount of resistance training. So your muscles are, you know, engines, essentially. They're only going to get the stimulus to grow more engines if you put that type of resistance onto them. 80% of your glucose is supposed to be going to your skeletal muscles. So if you don't have more muscle mass, then you're going to have the glucose going out to the periphery. And so I don't believe in that carbohydrates are evil for people. Mm-hmm. There's just a threshold that certain people can tolerate. And it's mostly based off of how much muscle mass they have. So looking at the markers of insulin, small dense LDL, you can kind of get a feeling like, hey, this person, however many carbohydrates they're eating, their body's not processing it that well. Mm-hmm. It's not, oh, go completely low carb. It's focus on how do you improve the skeletal muscle health.
When you spoke of medication use for insulin resistance, are you talking about metformin?
Often metformin.
Okay. Because I think that's a really good drug still. It's safe. It's been around for a lot of years. I think some comparisons would be berberine. I don't know if you use berberine a lot. I usually kind of try that initially, if it's possible. You know, there's some good research on it.
Correct. And I use a lot of berberine in my practice because it also does have an effect on the lipoproteins. You know, it has an effect on, you know, decreasing oxidative stress of the glycocalyx. So I often use it. But from a glucose standpoint, it probably is pretty similar at lowering it as well as metformin. But metformin does tend to have a benefit of helping with some weight loss, where I have not seen so much with berberine.
Yeah, right. Do you tend to utilize glucose monitors with your patients?
For the ones that are interested, yes. Yeah. And I don't think people have to do a CGM or continuous glucose monitor, 365. I think, quarterly, a couple times a year, maybe, or if they're making a big change in their life, if they're going to change up their nutrition, they're changing up their exercise routine, see what's going to change with your glucose doing those things. But the often thing that's interesting with the glucose monitors is, yes, you'll find out your trigger foods that tend to spike your blood sugar, but you'll see how much your stress in your life actually affects it. And especially lack of sleep. If you short sleep yourself, you're going to see your fasting glucose in the morning much higher than you would expect, even if you're, quote, eating low carb. That cortisol surge from the stress and the short sleep is going to keep raising your blood sugar.
Yeah, I think they're really great tools. You're right. If anything, it just brings awareness and to the effects of how it's happening, and you can make all those real-time changes. So women tend to catch up with men for their heart disease risk, probably a little later, but I think around age 55, the risk starts increasing due to the drop of estrogen. Can you talk about the effects? What are the benefits of estrogen on our blood vessels? What's happening to our blood vessels as we start to lose estrogen?
So from a vascular standpoint, the estrogen's main benefit is that it helps support nitric oxide. Nitric oxide is a gas that's produced right on the lining of the arteries. That gas signals the muscle and the artery wall to relax, and that keeps flow normal. Nitric oxide also acts sort of as a repellent. It prevents the cholesterol particles from sticking to it. And the body needs estrogen to make that happen. And so it's not only for women, it's also for men. So for men, who end up going on hormone replacement therapy, testosterone, much of the benefit of testosterone is not only from, better libido and muscle mass, it's the aromatization of the testosterone back into estrogen. And it's that estrogen effect for the men that's helping their bone mineral density and helping the arterial relaxation. So with the loss of estrogen, that in menopause for women, that is one of the times you start seeing blood pressure start increasing. And it's often tied to this nitric oxide availability.
How do they know they have loss of nitric oxide? And what are we doing to kill it, first of all? Because I was just talking to a patient about it yesterday. And sometimes I think they're like, look, I just want to talk about my hormones. I don't want to talk about all this other stuff, but I try to explain, this is so important. So talk about what we're doing to kill nitric oxide. How can we measure it? And what kinds of things can we do to replace it or build it up or whatever?
Also great questions. And what I spend time with every single patient is that, yes, they often come in here and they're like, I have high cholesterol, but we're going to get to that. What's going on with nitric oxide? Because it's that fundamental. Nitric oxide protects your arteries. If you don't have high or optimal levels of nitric oxide in your arterial system, you're much more likely to go down the pathway where you're going to develop plaque in the arteries. You have 60,000 miles of blood vessels. You got to get blood flow and nutrients into tissues. You got to get waste products out of those tissues. So there's two main pathways that the body makes nitric oxide for the vascular system. One is directly on the arterial lining. As blood flow crosses over the glycocalyx, nitric oxide gets produced. This is when you convert arginine into citrulline with an enzyme called endothelial nitric oxide synthase. But after the age of 40, that enzyme becomes less and less available to make that reaction happen. Just starts slowing down. There's a backup pathway through your saliva where when you eat nitrate-enriched foods, which is mostly dark green leafy vegetables and beets, if you have nitrate-reducing bacteria, they will break down the nitrates in those foodstuffs. You swallow it. And then if you have stomach acid, your body will convert it over ultimately to nitric oxide. But where people can break their body's ability to do this is that they're drinking water with fluoride in it, if they're using antiseptic mouthwash, if you disrupt the oral microbiome, much like if you disrupted the gut microbiome, you don't have the good guys around to help you out. The other issue is that if you're taking a lot of acid blocking medications, the proton pump inhibitors, the H2 blockers, if you don't have stomach acid, you can't break down proteins. If you can't break down proteins, you can't make enzymes very efficiently. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you're on a acid blocking medicine, you need to talk to your doctor, like, is this a long-term thing that I need to be on? Or can I work on getting off of this? Because if you can't come off of it, you're often going to need to support the body's ability to make nitric oxide then. So that's the challenges. And then how do you test for it? There's some indirect ways. You can do salivary nitric oxide test strips, kind of like litmus paper. You put saliva on it, and the brighter red it is, the more nitrates you can make, or nitric oxide you can make through the salivary pathway. Indirect ways is you can monitor your blood pressure. Your blood pressure is greater than 120 over 80 millimeters of mercury, often you'll have a nitric oxide deficiency. There's testing that you can do that looks at pulse wave velocity, which is basically like how fast do the arteries expand and contract. They should be like an accordion and snapping back very quickly. They should not be like a lead pipe. There's devices like the Max Pulse that we have in our office. There's various vendors that make these types of devices. There's a test called the EndoPAT, which is like a stress test for your arteries and tells you exactly percentage-wise how much your arteries can dilate by releasing nitric oxide. A normal scan should be greater than 2.1 or doubling of your arteries in size. Some of the blood tests we talked about earlier, asymmetric dimethylarginine, symmetric dimethylarginine, those are good markers that if those are high, you likely have low nitric oxide. If you have high homocysteine, likely have low nitric oxide. If you have high uric acid, likely low nitric oxide. And then one last test is the urine microalbumin creatinine test, often checked in patients with high blood pressure or diabetes. But if you're leaking protein into your urine, that's a marker that the endothelium to the kidneys are getting damaged. So it's kind of like leaky kidney arteries. If those are damaged, you're likely having endothelial dysfunction in the rest of the 60,000 miles of blood vessels.
Wow. How, when you think about blood pressure, 120 over 80 is optimal, you said, right? With women, or just with anybody, actually, how often, like, I always want my patients to be checking their blood pressure at home. And again, they're like, you know, they don't get it. So how often do you have your patients check their blood pressure? Do you have them routinely check it at home? What do you do?
So blood pressure is the number one modifiable risk factor for stroke and heart attack. And it's, you know, the silent killer for a reason. You generally cannot feel that your blood pressure is elevated. You know, if you can feel that your blood pressure is elevated, it's often causing retinal issues. You know, you have pounding headaches. You're at much higher risk of having events at that stage. How often I ask patients to check it? It really depends on where their blood pressures are starting at. But first off, you know, how to check a blood pressure is important. So one, you want to have a brachial cuff. You want a cuff that fits on your bicep. You want to avoid the ones that are wrist-based because often those are very inaccurate. You can sort of know if your home monitor is well-calibrated by take your blood pressure monitor into your doctor's office, have them check it with whatever machine they have, check it with your home machine and see how close those are to calibrate it. I've seen devices 40 points off either way. And so first, know that you're recording it effectively. Next is, ideally, no caffeine, no alcohol, no nicotine in your system. You don't want a bunch of stimulants in your system that are going to raise your blood pressure. There's a circadian biology to your blood pressure. So blood pressure is going to change throughout the day. Blood pressure is going to start rising early in the morning because that's when time your body is supposed to be getting awake and going out to hunt or gather food. And your blood pressure naturally should be dropping later in the evening time. And then it drops 10 to 15% while you sleep. So generally be consistent when you check it, but often I have patients start with at least checking their morning blood pressure. And then if it's, you know, something where they're, you know, modulating with different medications, often they'll check another time during the day. But you generally want to check it sitting down, feet flat on the ground, your back supported, your arm should be at heart level and resting on a table or something in front of you, and then press the button and take a recording. Now, the guidelines say you're supposed to wait 5 minutes, repeat, wait 5 minutes, repeat. Okay, I often would not recommend people do that. That's really challenging to do that every day and live your life the way you want to. So at least take one. And if the number is, quote, normal or where your doctors want, okay. But if the number doesn't make sense to you, then wait a couple minutes and repeat it and then average out those blood pressures. But really, almost everybody blood pressure, even up into their 80s and 90s, really should be near that 120 over 80 mark. That's the sprint trial data, so that people who hit that mark will have less cardiovascular events than people who run 140 over 90, or just a little bit high, or I just have white coat hypertension. It's like your arteries don't know the difference. You know, if there's high pressures in there, there's a chance that the arteries are going to get scratched up with that pressure. But then there definitely are people that got white coat hypertension. So how do you really diagnose that? Well, which white coat hypertension is basically synonymous for a stress-induced hypertension. So often tell patients, like, your blood pressure is up just because you're getting checked at the doctor's office. Do you think it's up when you're in traffic? Do you think it's up when, you know, you're standing in line at the store? It's probably up whenever you're under stress. Your arteries don't know the difference. So in those individuals, you would generally recommend a 24-hour ambulatory blood pressure monitor, because those monitors will check your blood pressure, depending on how you set them, you know, every 15 to 30 minutes. You then have an average throughout the day. You'll get what's known as the blood pressure load. So how many times is your blood pressure over 140 over 90? And then it will assess, does your blood pressure drop appropriately while you sleep? That's your dipping status. Your blood pressure should drop at least 10% while you sleep. If your blood pressure stays the same or worse, goes up, often that's associated with increased risk of stroke and heart attack early in the morning. And it's also sometimes a red flag that you may have sleep apnea. And that's why your blood pressure is so high. So sleep apnea and hypertension are very closely linked. So If you have high blood pressure and you don't have a reason why, you probably want to get a sleep study to make sure it's not sleep apnea driving it. And you do not need to be obese to have sleep apnea. I recently went through an evaluation for myself. Yeah, I sleep very, very well. I have, 99th percentile sleep, according to my trackers, and my brain's working exactly the way I want. I was like, I want to know what my patients go through. And when I was talking to the sleep specialist, they was talking about, like, people who've had dental work as a kid. I had some teeth extraction for braces. Their oral pharynx is narrower, and so they're more likely to have some snoring, and they may have some mild apnea, even though they don't have a big neck, even though they're not overweight. So, just because you don't think that you have sleep apnea, well, if you have high inflammation, high blood pressure, you have heart rhythm issues, you probably still want to get a sleep study.
Yeah, that is so interesting. Yeah, it's so important. I mean, that's a huge risk factor for sure. And now I think, they can do it at home, I think. Right. I don't know if it's as accurate, I guess. They're doing
most
it
most of the time it is. Yeah, for sleep
which is awesome. Because I don't know if I could sleep in the lab. I don't know that I could. I don't know how accurate it would be. Yeah. Well, we talked about cortisol. It does seem to tend to raise as we go through menopause, unfortunately. We talked a little bit about stress, but a lot of people are under stress. Talk about that with the effects on the cardiovascular system, because it's a big focus, but what can we do? We all have stress. And I feel I'm seeing a lot of people that just don't think that they can do anything about it.
Correct. I mean, there's reports that like 80% of doctors' office visits are due to either acute or chronic stress. So stress is ubiquitous, It is normal. It's what allowed us to survive as a species. Now, you can kind of break it down into physical and mental stress. So physical stress, that's usually good stress. You go to the gym, you put in a good workout, you stress the body, you go to sleep, you recover from that stress, and then you are stronger again and can go do it again. Mental stress, very common. You use your brain. I'm sure there's some mental stress in both of us trying to answer these questions right now. But it's not the stress is necessarily the issue. It's how well do you respond or recover from the stress? And some people are better able to do that. So this is more about how well is your vagal tone, basically be able to dial back down when needed. So people often understand analogies like you go to the gym to work out or you work out at home. Side note, like I don't like working out at the gym, so I work out at home. But the thing is, like, you stress the physical part of the body, it recovers. But you also can train the mental side. So this is where meditation, biofeedback, box breathing, yoga, prayer, there's different heart rate variability trainers. This is where you're training the vagal nerve to calm the body down when you need it to come back down. There are certain people that have certain SNPs, particularly the COMT SNP, catecholamine methyltransferase trip SNP, that adrenaline will stick around 3 to 4 times longer when it's been activated. So The tiger's chasing you. You got to dump adrenaline, get away from the threat. But the people with the COMT gene, it sticks around 3 to 4 times longer. These are the people that tend to have more anxiety or palpitations or high blood pressure, especially after a stressful event. So you may just say that I'm a stressful person. That is possibly true, but that doesn't excuse you from having to try to figure out how to mitigate it. So you might have to learn how to do better meditation or yoga or deep breathing. Just know that you're likely to be triggered at times. So it's not the stress, it's the response to the stress that's the issue for some people.
Right. A couple things. When people come to you, what do you do, like some specific genetic markers? I mean, we've mentioned multiple genetic markers. What are some routine things that you look at? As far as like you talked about diet, maybe specifically, you know, keto may not be for everybody because they have these different genetic markers, which is a great reason to individualize care. But what do you look at when you're checking genetic markers?
So I don't do a giant genetic panel on every single person.
Okay.
But if people are looking for like the four biggest cardiovascular genes, the one is under control of LPLA. So LPLA is heavily genetically influenced. So check LPLA and everybody at least once. Okay. If it's normal, you don't need to ever check it again. If it's high, there's some debate, should you be checking it? Because right now we can't really lower it. So you might not have to keep repeating. Just know that, hey, that person's high. And then eventually if these drugs come out to the market and work, then you would test and see, did it come back down? ApoE is an echo. You can check that one time. You get one copy from your mom, one from your dad. You get the 2, a 3, or a 4 allele. Normal is a 3 and a 3. But if you have an ApoE4 allele, there's higher levels of lipoproteins, an increased risk of insulin resistance, diabetes, and increased risk of Alzheimer's. Not a deterministic gene. If you have ApoE4, it does not mean you're getting Alzheimer's, but you're at increased risk of that. Then there's a gene colloquially known as the heart attack gene, 9P21. Doubles or triples your risk of having a cardiovascular event over somebody who doesn't have it. Wow. Often it's through the inflammatory and endothelial function pathways. There's another gene sometimes checked called KIF6. Don't always check it, but if people have a family history of aneurysms, often we'll check that one. That's baseline for most people.
Okay.
A lot of patients come in, they've already had their MTHFR genes checked, but if they haven't, I will check that because that has effect on methylation pathways, which have an effect on homocysteine. And then depending on if they're coming in for blood pressure issues, Cardia X panel from Vibrant America, there's about 25, 30 different SNPs that can be associated with high blood pressure. So often patients say, like, I've tried all the lifestyle things, my blood pressure is still high. I can show them, like, you've inherited 8 genes that would make it more likely you're going to have high blood pressure. So there is a large genetic influence to blood pressure. Then if somebody has more of a lipid abnormality, there's a company, GB Insight. It's an oral swab that looks at 120 some odd SNPs. And so you can know if that person has familial hyperlipidemia, or they have a monogenic gene, like one gene, they're going to have very high lipids, or is it polygenic, multiple genes combined together to give that person this high lipid profile. So GB Insight can kind of also guide you to letting people know, like, is a high fat diet going to work for this person? Or statins going to potentially be problematic for them? So I will fine tune it to the person's individual risk.
So if somebody has a genetic issue with blood pressure per se, say that they run high, knowing the detriment of having that, is that somebody you would consider actually putting on blood pressure medication then?
Correct. If they can't get it down with their exercise, their stress mitigation, their sleep, and they don't have sleep apnea, then yes, the nice thing about this panel is that it also lists certain medications that tend to work for certain of the gene SNPs. So for example, there's one that has an effect on aldosterone levels. If you have high levels of aldosterone, you hold on to more sodium. If you hold on to sodium, you hold on to water. Well, the diuretic spironolactone blocks aldosterone. So people who have this particular gene tend to respond better to spironolactone than somebody who doesn't have that gene.
Wow. It's crazy. Just in general, like how blindly we practice medicine sometimes, not knowing all of these underlying issues that could be going on with patients. It's crazy. As a preventative screening, a lot of times a calcium CT score is ordered. If you see somebody's ApoB elevated or lipo-A, like lipoprotein little A, is that what prompts you? Or do you tend to just, as a screening tool, get that? And then also, do you look at people's carotids as preventative?
Correct. You have 60,000 miles of blood vessels, so you have to look at multiple vascular beds. because you know, your carotids and your coronary arteries, for the most part, are about 80% correlative. But I saw Paul Richardson actually earlier today, had moderate plaque in the coronary arteries, had none in their carotid. So you have to look at multiple places. But for most people over the age of 40, if you've not already had a heart attack, stroke, stents, bypass, often a good screening test is the CT coronary calcium scan, low-dose radiation scan that looks for calcified plaques in your coronary arteries. Your calcium score test really should be zero, but 6 out of 10 people's scores will be above zero after the age of 40. So it's not that it's above zero, it's what decade of life is it above zero? If you're 80 years old and your pops positive, okay. But if you're 40 years old and have a high calcium score test, you have a 5-alarm fire, you have to figure out what's driving so much plaque in your arteries at such an early age. There are more sensitive tests like the CT angiograms, but more radiation requires contrast, more cost. So I got to pick the right population for that one. And there's a test called the carotid intimal medial thickness ultrasound. It can assess the vascular age. You know, if your arteries are thickened, there's more likely that plaque is building up. So you can use that one as kind of a surrogate for like, is this person's plaque old? Or are they still actively adding plaque to their arteries? Because you can see the inflammation in the artery walls with that scan.
What never prompts a visit to you, a referral to you? Because I routinely do this for my women and midlife and beyond. They'll get like a low number. And in my mind, I'm like, okay, I know it's there, but when should I be sending them to you?
That's an individualized question. But yeah, because I think almost everybody should do this type of testing. They don't all necessarily have to come see me. But if your score is zero, it's a good starting point.
Okay.
But I still wouldn't leave an ApoB of 150 and say like, well, my calcium score is zero. I don't have plaque because the test doesn't see the soft plaque that can still be building up. So if you do a CT angio and it's low risk, then maybe you might be able to leave the lipids a little bit higher for a longer period of time. But I typically kind of break it down to the three categories. Like if the referring doctor is comfortable managing the ability to make nitric oxide optimal, can they get the inflammation under control? Can they lower ApoB to under 70? Then they don't necessarily need to refer into myself or a cardiologist.
Okay.
But if they're having trouble getting into goal, or they're going to have to use pharmaceutical agents that maybe they're not used to, like the PCSK9 inhibitors or bempedoic acid, then it's reasonable to send them into an integrative functional cardiologist.
Okay, we didn't really cover this yet, but supplementation for nitric oxide. I know Dr. Nathan Bryan, I've interviewed him. He's awesome. He has a supplement. Do you find them beneficial? Which supplements do you recommend? Actually, just in general, like for the heart, arteriosil, I think I've heard you mention before. What are some of the ones you like?
So again, it's always going to be individualized to the patient, but those products that you're mentioning, those can definitely be helpful for basically regenerating and supporting the endothelium. So if you're low in nitric oxide and it doesn't improve with nutrition, high nitrate diet, exercise, UVA sunlight exposure, then supplementation sometimes is reasonable. And there's different companies that make different nitric oxide lozenges. There's different capsules in some companies that make them. And I tend to use some various companies. There are some glycocalyx promoters. So the glycocalyx is a protective gel coat. These basically help regrow that gel coat if it's been injured. So one of those products is called Arteriosil from a company called Calroy. So if people have evidence on testing that their endothelium and their glycocalyx is impaired, often we'll give those agents to help support them then. Then figure out, what's abnormal in their blood test and, replace the deficiencies. So I don't think there's a cocktail that like every single person should be on fish oil or vitamin D or magnesium. It's individualized. But often there's supplements that will help support healthy ApoB levels, bergamot, berberine. But if those don't get you to the goals, then figure out what pharmaceutical agents might be useful for that individual.
Are you comfortable with fish oil supplements? I mean, there's some controversy. I even read a recent study that high doses could lead to AFib. I don't know if you saw that. I'm sure you did. So now I feel like I'm just a little cautious, like, hey, let's keep it at 2 or 4 grams a day. But what is your recommendation if the patient would benefit from fish oil?
That is always a moving target for sure. I mean, I always check the omega check levels. Often patients are low, especially here in St. Louis. Not a lot of access to fresh seafood, so a lot of people just don't eat a lot of seafood. But the guidelines are eat the seafood. It's brain food. It's artery promoting healthy food. So if I wanted to get like one nutrition tip, it would be like, you know, get your protein for your muscle mass and eat your seafood. It's that okay. critical. Now, the supplementation is just that. It's supplemental to your diet. And there are, quote, better fish oil products than others, but it is somewhat of a debate on do some of those fish oil products actually get into the brain cells? Mm-hmm. There's a, you know, quantum physics reason why it may not actually get in there, like a lock mm-hmm. and key. It may not. You may, your blood levels may look high, but they're not actually getting into the cells. Mm-hmm. So I often say, like, we may supplement, but we have no guarantee that this is absolutely working for you. And then you see the studies that shows that maybe it's increasing certain heart rhythm issues. And other studies that shows it decreases, you know, heart rhythm issues. So it's somewhat of a thing where it's like, I don't routinely recommend it for most people. You know, there's certain cases I would still do it, but not everybody.
Okay. Like there's other things that you can use for anti-inflammatory strategies, such as turmeric, or is there any other anti-inflammatory strategies that you, you know, we didn't mention?
Yeah. I mean, berberine's a very good one as well.
Okay. So in your office, I have seen your background as a giant mitochondria. Yes.
Giant mitochondria by me, yes.
When I talk about the mitochondria, again, people are like, okay, why does this matter? Can you talk about why the mitochondria are so important and how to support them?
So the mitochondria are the organelles in your cells. They do many things, but one of them is they make the energy for the cells. They're the engines. And your most energy, you know, dense organs are your heart and brain. The trick question is actually it's your ovaries, but those are generally not in use full time. Your heart and brain are always in use. So your heart may be up to one third by weight mitochondria. Mm-hmm. So if your mitochondria are dysfunctional or not making enough energy, then you end up with heart disease. If you have dysfunctional mitochondria in your brain, you end up with Parkinson's or Alzheimer's. So your mitochondria are the biggest determinant for how well you're going to age. So we talked about earlier in the conversation about your mom's health. You inherit your mitochondria only from your mom. So mm-hmm. the healthier your mom was, and the healthier grandma on that side was, that's your starting potential. Mm-hmm. So if those patients have very sick mothers, they're more likely to be sick earlier in life as well. And so the mitochondria, you know, they are very much tuned into the frequencies of the world. You know, they're basically like radar detectors. And they're exquisitely sensitive to light environments. So this is where sunlight and photobiomodulation are useful. And this is also sleep. Sleep is absolutely critical for mitochondrial, you know, repair. That's when the mitochondria, you know, do mitophagy and autophagy. They repair the damaged ones. And the next day you go out there and you, you know, stress the system again and they, you know, make energy for you. And then they repair at nighttime. So it's mostly proper light signals and sleep. That's really the starting points for them. Now, yes, there's supplements, but they're also supplemental to the light in your sleep.
I was going to ask you that. There's a ton of mitochondria supplements, and I've been told some people say they're useless, and others they're beneficial. I personally just take one. It's like a multi, like a MitoCore. You know, I don't know if it's doing any good or not, but my mom didn't last very long, so it does make me a little nervous. I want to talk to you about red light therapy and photomodulation, the benefits, but real quick, are you a fan of grounding? I mean, do you feel like that is important? I know some people are like, that's woohoo, but what do you think?
No, I think it is very useful. It's very beneficial to help lower inflammation. It helps with keeping the blood flowing like red wine, not so much like ketchup. You know, Dr. Steven Sinatra, who is like the original integrative cardiologist, you know, he helped, you know, kind of get this to be a more popular topic among even some of the general cardiologists, and had did some of the research. So when you're connected to their surface with bare hands, bare skin, you accept electrons into the body. Those electrons help quench inflammation. So no, I'm a big fan of it.
Okay, awesome. So let's talk about photomodulation, because I know you're a big fan of it. It's so cool. Let's talk about, how does it benefit us? How does it penetrate our tissues, especially our heart? What's the benefits? And what is it for people that don't?
So photobiomodulation, or PBM for short, that's the current way that they're calling this technology. You may also hear it as low-level light therapy or low-level laser therapy. It's using light therapy to change your biology. It's generally going to be the red and the infrared spectrum of light. And the acronym is RATS, reflect, absorb, transmit, scatter. So when light hits your skin, it either reflects off of it, it gets absorbed, and it gets taken up in the mitochondria, and it activates cytochrome C oxidase. So it produces more electron flow through the mitochondria. It also liberates nitric oxide from the mitochondria, which then can dilate blood vessels. But sometimes light, you know, will scatter and sometimes it goes straight through. But you're wanting to get it to be absorbed into the mitochondria where it will have action. Mm-hmm. The main use cases for it is for musculoskeletal injuries. Mm-hmm. Decreases inflammation, decreases swelling, it brings blood flow to the tissues, and it helps with collagen production. So wound healing occurs more favorably. Mm-hmm. So that's how most people utilize it. And there's, I believe, over 5,000 studies at this point on PubMed describing the benefits of photobiomodulation. But some of the other cases, you know, from head to toe, you know, there's laser caps that help with hair growth. There's face masks that help with collagen production and wrinkle reduction. There's oral devices for oral health. There's thyroid shields for people who have Hashimoto's. You know, you have stem cells that live in your sternum. So light can penetrate your sternum and activate stem cells. It's good potentially for leaky gut and bowel issues. Mm. And then sexual function. Some reports, maybe it helps raise testosterone. Seen some reports that it helps with fertility. And then definitely musculoskeletal. So, you know, below the waist and knees and ankles, they tend to benefit from photobiomodulation. So, big proponent of it, have an 8-foot-tall panel in my office to kind of educate patients on how it actually works. And they can experience a full body session if they're interested. And then send them home and give them some information if they're interested in, you know, high quality products, point them in the right direction to better known vendors.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that because so much on social media, people are seeing all these influencers and all these big infrared saunas. Not everybody can afford to have a big sauna, you know. So what are some other things that they can do? I think I even noticed that you had like red light bulbs in your home or wherever you were. I saw that.
Correct. Yeah, those are for more just kind of like circadian rhythm, you know, entrainment at nighttime. So I travel with a light bulb when I go to hotels and, you know, take out the one of the bulbs and then just leave the room red. So that is not technically photobiomodulation because there's not enough photon energy coming off those bulbs. Those are just for vision. So think of analogies like when you're doing PBM, that's a fire hose of photons. Red light bulbs are like the sink is just trickling. So it's okay. The photon energy or the radiance that you really are looking for. But I don't remember the beginning part of the question, but it was sort of like that, you know, I don't remember. We were talking about like
other products that
other products. Okay. Yes. Okay. Sorry.
Like what are some other things that it doesn't have to be a big production. They can benefit from smaller devices of red light.
There's smaller devices that are, you know, in the $200 to $300 range that are very reputable and, you know, they're, made by high quality vendors and you just more, I call it spot weld it. So you just, you know, set the like 1-foot by 1-foot panel in front of whatever hurts or whatever you wanted to treat. So, you know, if you had three places on your body that you want to treat, yes, you're going to have to kind of move around and, you know, you're going to be in front of the device longer, but that's okay. It's still going to work for you. It's that when people want kind of like a full body and be done in 10 minutes, they're going to need a bigger panel.
Right. Is there any, when we go back to women specifically in midlife and heart disease, I want you just a real quick before I forget to ask you, do women experience different symptoms than men? Is there things that they should be more aware of in relation to women and symptoms and signs of heart disease?
It's a good point. But I would first start with that. It's good that people are aware that the number one cause of women's demise is still heart disease. Mm-hmm. Breast cancer is scary. But that's 1 in 8 women, approximately. Coronary disease is 1 in 2 or 1 in 3 in women. So you're more likely to die of a heart attack than you are breast cancer. That being said, sometimes symptoms do present a little bit differently in women. My practice is set up to try to find people at the asymptomatic level. We're trying to find plaque in your arteries before you have your first symptom. But often symptoms are, and this can be in both genders, you know, it's fatigue, exercise intolerance, shortness of breath, chest discomfort. It's not necessarily described as pain, but there's some odd sensation in the chest. Sometimes that sensation will spread to the back, the arms, the neck. Sometimes in women, the symptom is just more nausea, you know, or fatigue. They don't necessarily have the elephant pressing on their chest type of sensation. But often cardiac chest discomfort is either brought on by physical exertion when the heart rate increases enough and you can't get enough blood flow past a fixed obstruction, or the person's under a lot of emotional stress. And the heart rate's picking up because the cortisol and the adrenaline's picking up. As that life stressor or the physical stressor slows down, the symptoms should start to reside. And then when you push yourself again or you're under that stressful situation again, the symptoms come back on. That's often a sign that there's something going on in the cardiovascular system, if that's the pattern then.
Mm-hmm. Interestingly, when I was studying menopause care and getting certified, I read about hot flashes being more than just a nuisance or a bothersome symptom. Mm-hmm. So I try to educate my patients now that this has actually been found to be a warning or pay attention to that you could have an increased risk for cardiac event. Is that right?
Yeah, those vasomotor symptoms, I mean, they may be associated with some degree of endothelial dysfunction. So mm-hmm. I've not totally tracked it well, but maybe I will going forward. Is like the women who described that, you know, if you supported their nitric oxide pathways or glycocalyx promoters, do they tend to have less vasomotor symptoms? That would be an interesting kind of a test to do.
Yeah, no doubt. Yeah, I do talk about that stuff a lot. One thing I want to talk to you before we get out of our conversation, I'm a big fan of circadian biology, and you are too. But when I talk to women about this, again, I want to talk about hormones and I'm all about it. So just talk about why it's so important. And really, it benefits everything, our hormones, everything really.
Yes. I mean, we are beings of light. There's 100,000 reactions happening in the body every second. And they all are coordinated by light signals, whether you can see that light or not. So your body is always sensing what time of day it is. It's always trying to figure that out. So two of the biggest Zeitgebers, or time givers in German, are the light that enters your eyes and the timing that nutrients enter your GI system. Well, the food one's pretty easy. You know, if there's food coming in, your body assumes it must be daytime. So evolutionarily, it would be ideal to eat during daylight hours and stop when it's dark outside. But the light signals, sometimes is a little bit more challenging to first grasp, but then once you understand, you're like, oh, this makes sense. So before they invented light bulbs, the first light you generally would have ever seen would have been sunlight. So you want to try to recreate that environment. So the first light that enters your eyes should be sunlight. It's balanced red and blue light. That light hits the back of the retina. There's a receptor back there called melanopsin. It's a blue light detector. The body sends a signal to a part of the brain called the suprachiasmatic nucleus, which is the central clock for the body. The light hits the eyes and tells the body, oh, it's daytime. And you start making certain hormones and neurotransmitters. Throughout the day, that light detector is sensing the sky, and the blue in the sky changes throughout the day. The sun would set, the blue light detector wouldn't see any more blue photons. The body gets signal, oh, it must be nighttime. Cortisol would start ramping down, and melatonin, the hormone of darkness, would start to ramp up. But now with the ubiquitous use of artificial light, and especially the screens, your brain keeps getting hits of blue light at the wrong times of the day. Your devices are set at something called 5500 Kelvin. It's the exact same color temperature as solar noon. So if it's 9 p.m. in your environment and it's dark outside and you're staring at your screen without your eyes protected, you're now telling your brain that it's still noontime and cortisol will stay high. Melatonin will be suppressed. Often your sleep quality will suffer because of that. Or if you're checking your glucose monitors, your blood sugars are going to be higher than you would expect. Cortisol is going to raise your blood sugars. So your body is always craving what time of day it is. And so try to recreate the environment the best you can naturally. But if you're in an environment where you can't do that, that's where the blue blocking glasses potentially come in. So I'm wearing a pair right now while I'm on the screens. Mm-hmm. So I want my brain to know what time of day it is. I don't want it to be tricked. So anytime I'm in front of screens, I have a pair of these glasses on. Now, if it's dark at home, I often have red lights on, so I'm not necessarily wearing the glasses mm-hmm. at home unless I'm going to have TV on. So the reason you want to be thinking about this is that if you don't get your light signals right, it's very hard to get your hormones right, and it's very hard to optimize your sleep and metabolism. So mm-hmm. if you're having trouble losing weight or sleeping better, start with working on your light signals first.
Does it stress our mitochondria? The blue light, the artificial light?
It causes oxidative stress.
Yeah. Oh, wow. And I heard you say on something else that gives us wrinkles, that can contribute to wrinkles. So that should get anybody's attention, the stress of it all. Well, thank you so much for being here. Before you go, I just usually like to ask a couple more questions. Like, what are two books or resources that you recommend that your patients read? I usually will give my patients books to follow up with. So what are your favorite recommendations?
One book, and it just dovetails into what we just discussed. It's Dr. Ponda's book. It's called The Circadian Code. It's a very well-written book that's for the layperson to be able to understand how the circadian rhythms really program your biology. And so once you read that book, the literally, figuratively, light bulb goes off in many people. Another book that just recently came out, my friend Dr. Lyon wrote a book, Forever Strong, and it's all about muscle-centric medicine. How do you optimize your muscle health for health span and longevity? So those are the two books I recommend most people look at this time.
When you talk about the circadian, I wanted to ask you this. Do you follow like time-restricted eating? Because I usually tell my patients that eat when the sun is up, not when the moon is. I don't get into the weeds of all that other stuff. That's pretty basic. But is that what you do?
Correct. Yeah, that's what I was saying. Like eat when it's light out is really the optimal time. I mean, you want your eyes to know it's daytime. You want your gut to know it's daytime. And the rest of the body is in sync then. If you're eating when it's dark out and your eyes are not getting the blue photons of light, the liver and gut are tricked into thinking it's daytime. And it will take 3 to 4 hours before they really shut off and then start processing all the other foodstuffs that you ate during the day.
Wow. All right. Well, thank you so much for being here. I've really enjoyed this conversation, learned so much. Tell everybody, I know you see patients in clinic and telehealth all over, right? So where can people find you?
So my practice, Apollo Cardiology, is located in St. Louis, Missouri. We work with patients all over the country, and now we actually had some international patients fly in to see us as well.
Wow.
We focus on getting to the root cause of cardiovascular disease and really help people not have heart attacks and strokes. So if people are interested in following me online, I'm mostly on Instagram. I do an IG live every Monday, 6 p.m. Central Time, and do an Ask Me Anything. So if there's questions you have, I'll usually try to answer it if it helps other people out. Mm-hmm. And then my website, drtwyman.com, has links to my other videos. If there's certain products that we discussed, there's links on my website as well. But if patients are interested in working with us, there's an application. If you apply, one of my team members will reach out to you and kind of work through some of the questions you may have about how best to work with us.
Awesome. Yeah, your Instagram lives are really great. You cover a lot of ground in those Instagram lives. Those are awesome. So thanks for doing those. All right. Well, thanks so much for your time. And hopefully we can do this again sometime.
For sure. Appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you. Thank you for joining me on the Midlife Wellness MP podcast, where we explore the various aspects of women's health during the menopause transition. I hope you found today's discussion insightful and empowering. Remember, your well-being is a priority, and I'm here to support you on your journey to a healthier and fulfilling midlife and beyond. Stay tuned for more engaging conversations and valuable insights. Wishing you good health and wellness. Until next time.